You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, Jumma Mubarak, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it being Friday, it is Brunch with Bernie, our time, our weekly one-hour town hall meeting, national town hall meeting, with a senator I think of as America's senator, although the good citizens of Vermont know that he represents them as the independent from that state, the independent senator from that state, Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. So what's on your mind today? What are you seeing happening in Congress and around the world, around the country?
Well, I think here in Congress, there is a great deal of discussion now about the so-called fiscal cliff and how we go forward on deficit reduction. Yesterday, right here in the Dirksen office building, we had, Tom, a great rally in where we had folks from the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, one of the strong senior groups. We had some of the unions there. We filled up not only the committee room, but we filled up the overflow room as well. We had hundreds and hundreds of people coming out. Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island joined with me. We had a number of members of the House there, Raul Grijalva, Barbara Lee, Jan Schakowsky, and others. And the message was very simple, and that is, yes, we have to do deficit reduction, but we have to do it in a way that is fair. We will not cut Social Security. We will not cut Medicare or Medicaid. We will ask the wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes. And what is gratifying is that polls that are coming in that I have seen just in the last week indicate to me that the American people absolutely and very strongly support that message. There was a poll that just came out a couple of days ago, commissioned by the AFL-CIO and done by the Peter Hart Research Associates, which showed that by a 64-17%, voters want to protect Social Security and Medicare benefits and address the deficit by asking the wealthiest people to start paying their fair share of taxes. So all over America, I think the American people are quite clear that especially in the midst of this horrendous recession, when millions and millions of people in the middle class and the working class are struggling to keep their heads above water, that you don't cut Medicare, you don't cut Medicaid, you don't cut education, but at a time when we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income in this country since 1929, when the wealthy are doing very, very well and their effective tax rate, as Mitt Romney's tax returns reminded us, are quite low, in many cases lower than middle-class tax returns, yes, we're going to ask them, and yes, we're going to ask large corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes. So this is the struggle that we are engaged in right now. I'm spending a whole lot of time on this as chairman of the Defending Social Security Caucus. In terms of Social Security, let me reiterate something, by the way, that Ronald Reagan pointed out back in 1983, I think it was, and that is that Social Security, because it is funded by the payroll tax, has nothing to do with deficit reduction. And in fact, Social Security has a $2.7 trillion surplus. So in terms of the whole deficit reduction debate, Social Security should be off the table completely. We shouldn't be talking about Social Security. But in terms of Medicare, Medicaid, education, our job is to protect the programs that working families in this country desperately depend upon, and to ask those people and those large corporations who are doing phenomenally well to start paying their fair share of taxes. I think we should be taking a hard look at military spending. We are now spending three times in terms of defense of what we spent in 1997. We're now spending almost as much money as the rest of the world combined. And I think we can look at defense and other government agencies for savings as well. But bottom line, is, yes, the wealthy are going to start having to pay their fair share of taxes, and yes, we're going to defend vigorously Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and other programs which are so important to the working families of this country.
Do you think that there's a chance that Elizabeth Warren will be put on the Banking Committee?
I would certainly hope so. Obviously, Elizabeth has a whole lot of expertise in that area. She has been one of the folks in this country who has paid the kind of attention and made the proper critiques that should be made with regard to Wall Street. Tom, as I have suggested to you many times, I think we are never going to see the growth of the middle class and an economy that we deserve as a nation unless we begin to deal with Wall Street. Wall Street is a world unto itself. It is unbelievably powerful. It has more money. The six largest financial institutions control assets equivalent to two-thirds of the GDP of America, $9 trillion. They write half the mortgages, two-thirds of the credit cards. How are you going to revitalize our economy? How are you going to put millions of people back to work unless you deal with the greed, the recklessness, and the illegal behavior on Wall Street? And certainly Elizabeth Warren knows as much about that as anybody does, and I hope that she will be on the Banking Committee.
What do you see as the big issues coming before Congress in the, not just the lame duck session, but as we go forward into the next year, Bernie?
Let me tell you what is going to be a huge issue, and I hope that people get involved in this process. This is going to be the first issue that we deal with on the first day of the new session, and that is filibuster reform.
Bingo.
And that has to be dealt with on the first day, because that is the day where the United States, the Senate, determines the rules under which they will live for the rest of the session. So on that day, we will bring up filibuster reform for the very simple reason that our Republican colleagues have used the filibuster in a way I think that no one ever intended it to be used. As I think I've mentioned before, Harry Reid, the majority leader, pointed out that when Lyndon Johnson was majority leader during his tenure, there was one filibuster. Since Reid has been majority leader, there have been hundreds of filibuster efforts. And what happens is one guy says, hey, I object to unanimous consent. You're going to need 60 votes to pass this thing. And they do this day after day, week after week. The result is that on issues and on pieces of legislation and amendments where we have 55 votes, 57 votes, 53 votes, we can't pass it because they are demanding 60 votes. Where we need to pass, get judges appointed, for example, we can't do that. Where legislation absolutely needs to get to the floor of the Senate so that it can get passed on behalf of the American people, we can't even get it onto the floor because we're backed up with all of these filibusters. So we need filibuster reform. I think folks are still working out exactly what the language will be. But to my mind, it is an absolutely imperative. We cannot continue to go forward as we have in the last 4 years when the main role of the Republican Party was to defeat every initiative coming from Democrats or Obama to make sure that Obama was a one-term president. Well, they didn't succeed on that. But now our job is to make sure that we can pass serious legislation with a majority vote.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be taking your calls next here on the Tom Hartman Program on our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. You can check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. And, of course, you can drop by ours, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, we've got a new app out, all kinds of places.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And on Bernie's website, I believe you can still sign the petition to roll back Citizens United. Plus, you can sign up for his newsletter, the Bernie Buzz. It's a great news source.
Taxes, after all, are the dues that we pay for the privilege of membership in an organized society. The privileges of membership in a civilized society have vastly increased in modern times. But I am afraid we have many who still do not recognize their advantages and want to avoid paying their dues.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here at our National Town Hall meeting. And Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Sanders, and congratulations on your reelection. I have two quick questions. I am a letter carrier. I'm 52 years old. I have had two rotator cuff surgeries, and I suffer from plantar fasciitis in both feet. They are talking about changing the Social Security age, and many letter carriers, this is a very physical job, and they want to move it to 72. And then our other dilemma is they were talking that in March, if Congress does not act, there will be about 220,000 layoffs because they're going to go to a five-day delivery. And I will take your question off the air. Thank you very much.
Well, Linda, thank you very much for the work that you do for our country in terms of making sure the mail moves. Our Postal Service plays an enormously important part in our economy. I have worked very, very hard last year and will continue to work in making sure that we defeat those efforts coming from right-wing Republicans who really want to dismember the Postal Service, who want to make drastic cutbacks in mail delivery, want to cut back on the delivery stations all over this country, cut back on rural post offices big time. We were able to stop them, not completely, but to a significant degree. So, Linda, we are going to continue our efforts. In fact, as soon as I leave this studio, I've got a few phone calls to make just on that issue, to protect the Postal Service, making sure that all of our people continue to get six-day-a-week mail delivery, and that we protect the jobs that are there. In terms of Social Security, that's another issue, as I indicated earlier, that I've been working very hard on. Social Security is an enormously successful program. Without Social Security, probably half of the seniors in this country would be living in poverty rather than the 9% who currently are. It is absolutely true, as Linda indicates, that there are many folks, CEOs of large corporations, virtually all Republicans, some Democrats, who want to make cuts to Social Security. And they're looking at different schemes to do that. Raising the retirement age certainly is one. A so-called chain CPI, which would lower the cost of living adjustments that people on Social Security receive, is another approach. They're looking at various approaches. We're going to do everything that we can to stop them. We just had a rally here on Capitol Hill yesterday to do just that. And our point is that Social Security should not be part of the deficit discussion at all, because it hasn't contributed a nickel to the deficit, because it's funded by the payroll tax, and the Social Security Trust Fund has a $2.7 trillion surplus. So, Linda, we hear you loud and clear, and many of us are aware that whether people are working delivering mail as you are, people are wait staff, people are working in factories, people are working in agriculture, people cannot wait until they're to get a retirement check from Social Security until they're 68 or 69 or 70. They can't do that. It is wrong, and we're going to do everything we can to prevent that from happening.
Mark in El Paso, Texas. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Hi, Tom. First of all, I want to thank the hard work you do, Senator. I get aggravated sometimes when I always hear the middle class, the middle class. I'm down here in Texas. I work for minimum wage trying to raise a family. And my question is, can we raise the minimum wage so at least I can get over the poverty line? Because it's really hard. Everything's gone up, from groceries, electric bills, you name it. You just get nothing. And you try, and I see how good my company does. And I'm like, man, like they don't have no will to hand down anything to help their own people out.
Mark, thanks very much for that question, and you are absolutely right. The issue is not just the middle class. The issue is lower-income people who are struggling to stay alive on $9 an hour or $8 an hour. Often those folks do not have health insurance. Sometimes they live in states where it's hard for their kids to get Medicaid and health insurance. So, Mark, you're absolutely right. As part of a social justice agenda, we have got to raise the minimum wage. In the state of Vermont, our legislature and governor have supported annual COLA increases to deal with the issue of inflation. Our minimum wage at the state level is a lot higher than it is at the federal level. But I think you're right that we need to raise the minimum wage federally as a floor. And if states want to go higher than that, that's great. So thank you very much, Mark, for that very important point.
Just a minute to the break here. We're Jeff in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Quick question for Bernie.
Yes, Mr. Sanders. Congratulations on your overwhelming victory, and thank you for serving.
Thank you.
I would like to know your thoughts on the idea of placing a fee on stock transfers.
Jeff, count me in as one who believes very strongly in that. And last year we introduced the most comprehensive dental care legislation ever introduced in Congress. And one of the ways that we propose to pay for that is through a fee, what we call a transaction fee, on stock exchanges, touching on the big traders, not the little people. I think when you do that, you accomplish two things. First of all, even a tiny fee can bring in a significant sum of revenue to the federal government. And second of all, a fee like that can put a damper on some of the incredible speculation that goes on in Wall Street. So, yes, I believe in that very much.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. More right after this. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Sign up for the Bernie Buzz. Sign his petition to amend the Constitution to roll back Citizens United.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, I go so far as to say sanders.senate.gov is also a great news site. They really do a great job with that website. Check it out. Welcome. It's Friday. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Scott in Aurora, Colorado, listening on AM 760 out of Denver. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, Tom and Senator. Recently, I think Wednesday, Tom was talking about the Republican refusal to talk of investments in America and only talking of spending. And it seems to me that they also refuse to talk about the people's investment in Social Security and Medicare, and instead use a belittling term, a belittling term such as requirements, or requirements, entitlements. I've recently heard it reframed as earned income benefits, and I was wondering if you feel that this reframing is a possible route to strengthening the conversation for the people's position, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, thank you, Scott. You raise a very important point. So let me just say this. When we talk about the economy, first point that we have to know is that today real unemployment is not 7.8%. It is closer to 15% if you include those people who have given up looking for work or working part-time. So when I think about the economy, I think about the need, the absolute need, to create millions of jobs and do it as soon as we can. And we do that by investing, as Scott indicated, in rebuilding our infrastructure, and we invest in transforming our energy system so we deal with global warming and we cut back on greenhouse gas emissions. Second of all, in terms of programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, in terms of Social Security, the American people have paid for what they are going to get. They have put 6.2% of their income into that program. Their employer put 6.2% into the program. And we now have in the Social Security Trust Fund $2.7 trillion surplus. In terms of how you phrase it, I think the issue is pretty clear, and that is that in a democratic, civilized society, we have got to understand that we are the only nation in the industrialized world that doesn't guarantee health care to all people as a right. So I'm going to do everything that I can to defend Medicare, which is a very successful and popular program, to do everything I can to defend Medicaid, but we have got to be more aggressive than just defending. I hope very much that my state of Vermont will be the first state in America which says that health care is a right, and we need to move forward with a Medicare for all single-payer program. We do not have to apologize to anybody to say that, yes, the children, the elderly, and working people should have health care. What we have to do is say that we as a nation are embarrassed that some 45,000 people die every single year because they can't get to a doctor when they should because they don't have health care. And millions of people are suffering in pain today because of dental decay because they can't find a dentist who will treat them. And that millions of people hesitate going to the doctor when they should because they don't have the money to cover their deductible. So I think on this issue, you know, in Mitt Romney's infamous video where he was recorded speaking to his wealthy friends, and he said, some people in America, they believe that health care is a right. Well, you know what? Count me in as one of those people who believe that health care is a right. In a moral, democratic society, everybody has got to be entitled to health care. Nobody should hesitate going to the doctor when they're sick because of their lack of insurance. People should not be suffering because they don't get to a doctor. We've got to get on the offensive. So our message should be, health care is a right.
Ian, in Youngstown, Ohio, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
I love XM, but Tom, you're the best of the best. It's an honor, Senator Sanders. I want to talk about redistricting. Ohio was light blue, and that includes the congressional races, and yet we've got a very red legislative body. Issue two failed, which I can only assume that people didn't understand what that was, that allows a very Republican legislature to go in and do even further redistricting. It seems like it's going to be insurmountable to win back the House based on gerrymandering.
Well, Ian, thanks very much for raising that point. In this campaign, this is what progressives were up against. As a result of Citizens United, we were up against an unbelievable, unprecedented amount of money, and you certainly in Ohio saw that coming against your very fine Senator Sherrod Brown. Obama's campaign saw it as well. Billionaires by the dozens put huge amounts of money trying to defeat Obama and progressive candidates all over this country. Number two, you saw voter suppression. You saw efforts trying to make it harder for senior citizens, for low-income people who might not have driver's licenses to be able to participate in the political process. And the third area that we saw during this campaign, and that's what Ian is talking about, is this incredible redistricting and gerrymandering that took place in Republican states. I mean, gerrymandering is not a new idea. In fact, it's named after a guy who lived a couple of hundred years ago, I think. But I think the Republicans took it to an entirely new level. The truth is that Democrats actually won more votes in House races than Republicans did, but were only able to pick up, I think, 8 or 9 seats in the House because so many districts were created that protect incumbent Republicans. This is an issue that we are going to have to deal with, I think, through the courts, as well as state by state, Ian. No simple solution to that, but you're right in saying that it is a very significant issue.
Dave, in Murphy's, California, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders, and thank you, Tom, for this great show. Could you please give me your thoughts on two simple ideas to help solve America's economic problems? First, a minimum alternative corporate income tax for all American megacorporations who have millions for political campaigns, yet pay zero taxes. Would this help return missing proceeds to America's budget deficit? And second, I understand America's largest export today is petroleum. Would a national energy policy that says no net export of American drilled petroleum bring us strength and security?
All right, Dave, thanks for your questions. You've raised significant issues. I'm not sure that your particular solution is the best way to deal with them. Right now, in terms of your first point, we have a tax system which is in a significant way written by lobbyists representing large corporations here in D.C. We have a tax system which enables one out of four profitable corporations to pay zero in taxes. We did a study of this last year. We documented, I think it was, some 20 separate corporations, many of them in energy, many of them on Wall Street, who made huge profits, paid nothing in taxes, and in some cases actually got a rebate from the IRS. Should we end this absurdity? The answer is absolutely we should. Is a minimum alternative approach one way that we might look at? Yeah, probably other ways will be better. But the bottom line is that when you have a corporation earning billions of dollars in profit, that corporation certainly should be paying taxes. In terms of petroleum, let me say this. I think, if you like, I wouldn't call it a sleeper issue, but an issue that is certainly not getting the attention that it deserves is the issue of global warming, of climate change. Tom, you may have seen on the front page of the Washington Post last week a very, very frightening article. And what the article said is that those scientists who most study this issue now believe that the worst-case scenario in terms of the warming of the Earth may, in fact, be the most likely scenario.
Yes,
and they
that.
Are talking about the possibility, think about this, that at the turn of this century, the year 2100, this planet might be 8 degrees warmer than it is today in less than 90 years. That is unbelievable.
It's what James Hansen said would be incompatible with our species.
Right. I mean, so you're talking about literally the future of civilization, because when you have that kind of warming, it will wreak havoc from one end of this planet to the other. And I think that the president has got to put this issue front and center and make it clear. We cannot continue to depend upon fossil fuels for our energy. We must make a fundamental transition to energy efficiency and to sustainable energy. We have to do this for the future of this planet. We have to do this to prevent spending billions and billions of dollars to repair the damage done by these extreme weather disturbances like Hurricane Sandy.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls from the United States Senate here today. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And don't forget to not only check out Bernie's website, but sign up over there for his newsletter. It's at sanders.senate.gov. Welcome back. Turn on your radio and your TV. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. And Bob in Marseille. Is it Marseille or Marseilles, Illinois? How do you pronounce it?
It's Marseilles. There's nobody in town that can speak French.
Okay. Marseilles has been anglicized. Listening on WCPT, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. I've got a solution to the post office problem. We have to find the people that are coming out ahead. And basically, it's not just UPS and FedEx. If the post office fails, somebody since 2006 has been collecting all that money that's driving them broke. And basically, I know whenever I had a defined benefit or medical program for 40 years, if I didn't get any money paid in, I lost out. Who is going to be making the money? Who are the insurance companies that are collecting the money for the post office to provide that retirement and retirement medical insurance that are going to stick the money in their pockets when the post office bites the dust?
Well, Bob, I don't look at it like that at all. I think the major problem, I know the front pages of the papers, you know, every few months will tell you the post office is going broke and broke and broke. The fact of the matter is, while they do have problems, no question that email has taken away a lot of business from first-class mail, their major problem is that as a result, as Tom indicated a moment ago, legislation in 2006 insisted upon by the Bush administration, they have got to put an ungodly amount of money, much, much more than is necessary, into future health retirement benefits. In the Senate, I worked very hard on this issue. We essentially, for all intent and purposes, took that out. And we said to the post office, you're no longer going to have to make those types of contributions every single year. Unfortunately, our colleagues in the House have refused to move. Many of these guys would love to see the post office, in fact, go broke. They would like to see the post office privatized, and that's what we're up against. But bottom line is, it is Congress's fault upon the insistence of the president that we put a huge amount of money every single year into this future retiree health program, which has enough money right now. We don't have to put any more money into it.
Yeah, and that president was George Bush when that was passed.
Right.
Bernie, is that money invested in treasuries like the Social Security Trust Fund is?
Yes, or is it sitting in a bank someplace? Nope, it is earning interest, absolutely.
Okay.
I can't tell you exactly where it is sitting. I suspect it is invested in treasuries, but part of the revenue stream for the post office is the interest earned on that investment.
Interesting. Okay. I just wanted to make sure it wasn't Citibank, you know. Robert in Dundalk, Maryland. Is that right, Robert?
Yes. Senator, can you propose a change in the filibuster rules to lower the threshold to end debate from 60 to 55 solely for the issues, say, of natural disaster relief and for confirmation of cabinet agency and judicial appointments?
Robert, that is one of the ideas. I should tell you that right now, folks like Senator Merkley, Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico, and others, and I, are looking at a number of approaches. Senator Harkin had the idea that his approach had to do with going from 60, give it a certain amount of time, then you take it down to 58. Give that a certain amount of time, then you take it down to 55. So there are different options that are out there. I cannot tell you what the final conclusion will be. We have to, you know, bring a bunch of people together to do this. But I will tell you that on the first day of the new session, if I have anything to say about it, now I think the majority leader is on board on this. There will be change in filibuster rules in the United States Senate. There will be a serious effort to end the dysfunctionality and the obstructionism which is now taking place.
Okay, 2 minutes to the end of the show here. Daniel in Greensburg, Pennsylvania. Quick question for the senator.
Yeah, hi, Senator Sanders. I just wanted to see if we could get a vote on the Chinese currency manipulation bill. That is a bill that's going to create hundreds of thousands of jobs and won't cost federal government a cent. In fact, it'll bring tariff tax revenue into the federal government. And the fact that it's taken a year for Speaker Boehner, I don't think he's going to vote for it. But is there any way we can get it as part of a deal to get a vote on it, a yes or no, so the president can sign it? Thank you so much.
Daniel, the short answer is I certainly hope so. I think you're right. And I think that is exactly what we should be doing. We continue to have huge trade deficits with China, and currency manipulation is one of the factors in that. Tom, we're about to wrap it up.
Bernie, your thoughts
for
the week?
Let me just say this, just 2 points that I want to make. Number one, I hope everybody understands that on Election Day, our side won a very, very significant victory. The president ended up with 3 million more votes in the popular vote than Mr. Romney. Democrats won 25 out of 33 contested Senate seats, won some seats in the House. What is important now is for the American people to make it very clear to the president, to the Democrats, that they have got to govern as if they won, which they did, a significant victory. Yes, we're always open to compromise, but we won the election and the American people have spoken. And what that means to my mind is moving forward in deficit reduction in a way that is fair, protecting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, moving forward to a significant jobs program, putting people back to work, understanding that global warming is not a hoax, as some of our Republicans think, but a very, very serious crisis for this country and our planet. So there is a significant agenda that we need to push forward. And we need the American people to be supporting us in this effort. So that is my that's my concluding message, Tom.
Okay, and a fine one it is. Senator Sanders, thank you so much again this week for being with us. It is always an honor to have you on here, sir. We will be back with more. Thank you, Bernie.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, a lot in the news today. This is Bob Fitrakis, I believe, was. Let me get over to Truth Out here. I had printed this out, but it's... Where did it go? It's on the printer. Here we go. Why Roe failed to deliver Ohio on Election Day. What happened in Ohio this time around? But what Bob Fitrakis points out is that in the book Boss Roe, and thank you, Danielle, and we have had the author of that book on this program. He's been on our, in fact, he was one of our Conversations with Great Minds. You can find that over at conversationswithgreatminds.com, half-hour discussions. In that book, he documents how in 2004, Karl Rove organized this system where the Ohio vote was counted in Ohio, and at 11:13 p.m. at night, the entire Ohio voting system crashed. All their computers crashed. A minute later, they came up. In that minute, all the votes had been rerouted through a server system in Tennessee, and so all the vote totals flowed back into the system in Ohio, and John Kerry lost, even though the exit polls showed him winning. And not only did he lose, but he lost specifically in... There was a series of counties here. Delaware, Butler, and Warren counties. And suburban Cincinnati. These counties, Bob Fitrakis writes, these three counties, Delaware, Butler, and Warren, provided more than Bush's entire Ohio victory margin of 119,000 votes in 2004. So what happened in Ohio this time? Interestingly enough, as Fitrakis notes, curiously, the Ohio Secretary of State's vote tabulation website went down at 11:13 p.m. and was mentioned by Karl Rove on the news. This is 1 minute earlier than the time on election night 2004 when Ohio calls votes were outsourced to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and then the vote flipped for Bush. Now, this is not some, wild claim. Vanity Fair contributing editor Craig Unger wrote the book Boss Rove. It's right there in the book. You can read it. This time, the Cuyahoga County vote tabulation site went down as well. So when these vote tabulation sites came back up a minute later, Now, back in 2004, when they came back up, all of a sudden the numbers had flipped from John Kerry winning to George W. Bush winning. But this time, when they went down, Barack Obama was winning and Sherrod Brown was winning and others. And when they came back up, Barack Obama was winning and Sherrod Brown was winning. So what was different this time, last week, from 2004? Well, this is where it gets really interesting. I mean, really interesting. Wong Kett has posted a letter that is dated 6 November 2012 by Orca Killer and the Great Oz of Anonymous. And let me just share it with you. It's one of the things that causes me to think that this definitely is anonymous is the kind of semi-anachronistic and flowery language that they use. You know, it's like they're talking, not just wearing the masks of Guy Fawkes, but of the era of Guy Fawkes. Greetings to the good people of the Velvet Revolution. Pleased we were to see that you put your faith in the hands of we protectors of democracy, and tempted too to claim your generous reward, but wealth does not drive us. 2 months prior to your offer, we chose to take action against those who have subverted the will of the people in past elections, which resulted in terrible destruction across the globe. I think it's reasonable to assume they're talking about the 2004 election and the way it was stolen in Ohio electronically by Karl Rove. We began following the digital traffic of one Karl Rove, a disrespecter of the role of law, knowing that he claimed to be kingmaker while grifting vast wealth from barons who gladly handed him gold to anoint another king while looking the other way. After a rather short time, now keep in mind, Karl Rove put a lot of money into this voter database, this Get Out the Vote, GOTV, Get Out the Vote, program called Orca, Orca the Killer Whale. Okay, back to the letter from Anonymous. After a rather short time, we identified the digital structure of Karl's operation and even that of his orca. This was an easy task in that barn doors were left open and the wind swept us inside. So what did we do with these doors? Did we leave them open and catch the thieves as they steal the prize? Or do we close them so they cannot steal the prize? Our decision? Protect the citizens. We coded and created what we call the Great Oz, a targeted, password-protected firewall that we tested and refined over the past weeks. We placed this code on more than one of the digital tunnels and their destinations that Carl's not-so-smart worker bees planned to use on election night. We noticed that these tunnels were strategically placed to allow for tunnel rats to race to the server sewers from three different states. Ah, yes, Karl tried to make it appear that there were more than three, but we quickly saw the folly of his ploy. We watched as Karl's little boys and girls confidently ran their tests while Karl told his barons to smoke cigars. So apparently what they did, what Anonymous did, if this is to be considered true, and this, I mean, you know, here's the question. I mean, Bob Petraeus, there's a lot of people scratching their head. He writes, was the fix in on Election Day in Ohio? The questions surrounding Election Day activities in Ohio and Karl Rove's now infamous meltdown on Fox TV election night are causing a buzz in the election integrity movement. Of course, we don't know for sure what happened, but we know the circumstances were eerily similar to election tampering techniques the Free Press discovered after the 2004 election. One major similarity was Rove's insistence to his colleagues on Fox News that the media consortium's exit polls were wrong in Ohio. This is the same claim he made in 2004 concerning Ohio and in 2000 concerning Florida. And then he talks about how, curiously, the Ohio Secretary of State's vote tabulation website went down at 11:13 p.m., mentioned by Rove on the news, 1 minute earlier than the time on election night 2004, when the Ohio votes were sent to Chattanooga, Tennessee, to be counted, tabulated, and sent back to Ohio. Okay. That last part, my words. Actually, his words were, and then the vote flipped for Bush. And then he adds, this isn't just a Free Press claim, but is well documented by Vanity Fair contributing editor Craig Unger in his book, Boss Rove. So you go through this whole thing that Bob Fitrakis wrote, and he's talking about how, you know, these software these experimental software patches that were supposed to be put on Ohio machines, they sued to stop that. They were unsuccessful, which kind of leaves, you know, Bob and the other people in the election integrity movement scratching their head going, what happened? How is it that Rove was able to steal Ohio in 2004 by moving the tabulations, the vote totals out of the state at 11:13 or 11:14 p.m. over to Chattanooga, Tennessee, where they got massaged, and then they got sent back to Ohio 60 seconds later? Just in time to announce that George W. Bush had won in 2004. How is it that that did not happen this year? Well, here we have Anonymous saying, ha-ha, we found the tunnel. We found the back door, and we put a firewall in it that's password protected, password supplied by Anonymous, not by Karl Rove. They kept the door open right up until election night. They watched Karl Rove's little rat scurrying back and forth in them, testing out the systems to steal the vote, and then they locked the fire door on election night, which makes so much sense when you consider how dumbfounded Karl Rove was that those numbers were wrong, especially in those three counties.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In fact, on TV, he was calling out the names of those three counties that got flipped in 2004. Why aren't they flipping? What's going on here? Yeah.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Anything goes Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. David in Loves Park, Illinois. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you, David?
Yeah, I'm doing great, and I'm going to get better, too, because you and I have talked in the past before. I called you, what, a year ago. I was one of the founding members of the Occupy Rockford movement, mm-hmm. and then I called you in March and kind of gave you a quick update, how I was a precinct committeeman. I was going to be running for Winnebago County Board in my area. It's a very Republican district. I ended up losing the election, but I got 42% of the vote.
Wow.
Doing the ground game and all the stuff that was necessary to run a good campaign.
That is great. And that's, I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with losing elections. Abraham Lincoln lost several before he became, you know, ultimately president. It is how you learn. And
it is, and what I'm doing is I'm taking the momentum that I have earned by doing that run, and now I'm actually going to be running for two different elected positions in this area. I'm running for a Loves Park City Council to be an alderman there,
right.
And also as a board of trustee for a local community college.
That is
nice. I made sure there was no conflicts of interest, and I'm good to go, and I'm going to be running for both, and hopefully I can get at least one of them.
That is
great. And start making a real good difference.
David, thank you for being part of the solution.
And, well, it's all because of you, actually. I've been listening to you for years. You've been talking to us about becoming a precinct committeeman to try and make a difference, and if you wanted to see the change, you know, do it yourself. And
yeah.
Well, that's what I'm doing, and you know, and I thank you for being that motivation for me, you know, along with listening to Bernie Sanders and just picking up on how things are done, and I can't thank you guys enough.
Well, David, thank you, and I guarantee you, your voice just inspired a whole bunch of people too.
I hope so. And then I have a website if I can kind of throw it out there.
Please do.
Okay.
Please do.
It's www, obviously, electdavidsaul.com. Now, it's still under
David, how do you spell how do you spell the last name?
Oh, S-O-L-L.
Okay. electdavidsoll.com. Okay.
Yes, and it's going under some makeovers because I'm going from one election type to another. But
right.
So anyone who's interested, you know, in seeing that and, you know, helping me out if they are willing.
Sure. That is great. David, I wish you the very best. Thanks a lot for the call, and good on you for becoming part of the solution rather than just, you know, complaining about the problems. It is I'm really impressed. I'm really honored that you called the show.
Well, I'll tell you what, the election's on April 9th, and I will certainly be calling you again once that happens, hopefully as an elected official from my hometown.
How cool would that be? David, good luck. I wish you the
Thank
best.
You,
Elect David, S-O-L-L, David Saul. is the website. Jerry in Amityville, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to discuss the so-called fiscal cliff,
right,
which I'm officially calling an attempted fiscal hijacking by Republicans.
I agree.
And I'd like to discuss this whole issue against the backdrop of Republicans trying, in my opinion, to use this issue as an excuse to do a major political assault on both Social Security and Medicare. And yet President Obama, in his news conference on Wednesday, in a conciliatory way, he said verbatim that we have to take a serious look at how we reform entitlements. And then he went on to mention how reform involves changes to entitlements. And I have problems with the president making that kind of concession offhand. And I also have problem with the president trying to use these entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare as bargaining chips to make a grand bargain. I think instead he and other Democrats have to stand up strong and tall and have to fight against Republican attempts to change these programs in any major way through means testing them or...
Totally agree with you, Jerry. And here's the thing. Calling, you know, it's great that you called into a talk radio show and you said this on the air and 3 million people heard you and said, okay, cool, you know, we'll do something about it or we'll make some calls. But you need to be calling your elected representatives as well. We all need to become activists. And then join groups. Go to pdamerica.org, for example, Progressive Democrats of America, and sign up. Go to movetoamend.org, sign up. Become part of the grassroots movements that make change happen in America. Don in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hello, it's great to be on the show.
Thank you.
I would like to discuss the British Petroleum court decisions in light of Citizens United.
Yeah.
And since they're now a person, could we not figure out a better punishment? Punishment as a person, such as, I think a great punishment for British Petroleum would be nationalize the company and take the profits.
Well, you know, I often talk on this program about, you know, using the metaphor of somebody walks into a 7-Eleven and picks up a dollar Hershey bar and takes a bite out of it. You know, do they owe a dollar to, you know, to 7-Eleven at that point? Or, you know, at what point does it become their property versus 7-Eleven's? BP has done what is estimated to be, and this is, you know, by some fairly reputable groups, around $50 to $55 billion worth of damage to the United States. The penalty that they are paying is $4.5 billion. So that's like, you know, walking into a 7-Eleven, taking a bite out of that chocolate bar and sticking it in your back pocket and on the way out saying, yeah, I know it's a buck, but here's, you know, here's 20 cents or here's 5 cents.
Sure.
Not only does it not compensate us for the damage that they did to us, but it doesn't deter others from doing the same. And deterrence should be as much of a part as recompensation or punishment. And I think, frankly, that the straightforward solution is to simply say BP can no longer do business in the United States. Your right to conduct your business in this country is null and void. You have to divest yourself of all your assets. You know, you have a sale, you sell them all off, you take the money back to England, and there are hundreds of American oil companies, some very large, some very small, a whole lot in the middle. And the gap, that opening, that vacuum that would be created by BP pulling out of the marketplace, there's a bunch of American companies that would happily jump into that. And it would be a good thing for America. It would be a good thing for our economy. It would be a good thing for the oil industry, frankly. You know, I mean, there is something to be said for policing an industry and making it work better. And it would be a wake-up call, I think, for the fossil fuel industry. We just had another meltdown. I'll tell you about that after the news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Well, I'll tell you right now, there was an explosion in the Gulf this morning. 4 people are hurt, 2 are dead, 2 are missing. It looks like a problem again. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, Bob Fitrakis over at freepress.net. That article you can find over at truthout.org or at freepress.net. And he's the co-author with Harvey Wasserman of the book, Will the GOP Steal America's 2012 Election? Question mark. And he says, so why didn't Karl Rove's guy Romney win Ohio as Bush did in 2004? All the voter suppression tactics, the usual dirty tricks, seem to be in place. Ohio Secretary of State John Husted was the new Blackwell, Romney the new Bush. Rove proved to be the same old Rove operating from his 2004 election theft playbook. And the conclusion that Fetrakis comes to is that this article on Forbes.com, election morning, and some very good reporting from Channel 19, oddly enough, the Fox station in Cincinnati. Keep in mind, the Fox stations are not Fox News. They are, it's the Fox television network. He thinks that, you know, the light of day caused it. I'm inclined to think that Anonymous actually closed the back doors that Karl Rove had to the tabulators. That makes a lot of sense to me. And if so, we all owe a great debt of gratitude to Anonymous. And I hope if they did this, that they documented it on video and they can put up a YouTube video showing, you know, here's Karl Rove's machine and here's how it was working and here's how we password protected a firewall in it so that his little rats could not scurry through the tunnels. That would be so cool. That would be so cool. Jim in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, two things. We just started a brand new chapter of Move to Amend here in Las Vegas.
Hey, good on you, Jim.
Yeah, very good. And last Tuesday, I worked the Board of Elections signing in voters here in Las Vegas. They have more security on every single slot machine in every little tiny casino in this state than they do on these voting machines.
Oh, yeah.
When I went in at 6 o'clock in the morning, there were 18 machines laying in the hallway on a flatbed cart.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, they put them on another cart for people to pick them up. It's absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah.
I started a petition on moveonsignon.org. I'm putting it on your blog right now. For Harry Reid to ask the Attorney General of the United States to look into not only voter suppression in all these states, in Florida and Ohio, but the security of these machines. I can go to any ATM in Las Vegas, and they have cameras on them. They have security on them. The voting machines, it's absolutely ridiculous in this day and age that anybody can go and pick up one of these machines.
Right, and not only that they're running, you know, old Windows operating systems. I mean, it is crazy. Jim, I'm totally with you, and good on you for putting that petition forward. Ross in Pittsboro, North Carolina. Hey, Ross, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show. I wanted to sort of bring up something that's been on my mind and sort of maybe challenge what seems to be a general progressive assumption of the Civil War mm-hmm. as being necessary for various reasons to save the Union and to free the slaves being the chief ones. And, of course, you know, these may be very good things, but you can look at a prize of the Civil War, like the 14th Amendment, which gave the rights of the vote to black people.
And that was actually the 13th Amendment.
That
but,
very piece yeah. of law was
you
manipulated so thoroughly that it now forms the basis of the concept of corporate personhood.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we move forward in advancing our agenda in various ways, how can we avoid that sort of manipulation to seemingly good causes?
Well, first of all, it was the 13th Amendment that gave the vote to African Americans. It was the 14th Amendment that gave them equal access to the criminal justice system, the legal system. No,
thank you.
13th Amendment says no person can be denied a vote based on the previous condition of involuntary servitude or slavery. The 14th Amendment says that no person shall be denied equal protection under the law. And the problem, of course, is that the 14th Amendment, that no person shall be denied equal protection under the law, was, according to the headnote, not the actual Supreme Court decision, in the 1886 Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case, according to a headnote written by a former railroad president, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, the son of the former governor of Massachusetts, very wealthy, very powerful fellow who was the clerk of the court. The clerk back in those days actually had more power and made more money than the justices did. He wrote the headnote and said corporations are people, and, you know, we were off to the races from that.
But I don't see that as the major unintended consequence coming out of the Civil War. If your question was, should we have fought the Civil War? Was the Civil War a good thing? Is that what you were trying to get to, Ross?
You know, that's a very broad and general way of framing the argument. I guess really what I'm trying to get to is, you know, how can we learn from that incident? And, you know, what are some specific ways that the Civil War was used to, you know, kind of provide the foundation needed for the military-industrial complex that came to dominate the world over the next...
Well, the Civil War certainly led to the Gilded Age. It certainly led to the rise of the railroads and the trusts, the combines, you know, the Rockefeller oil trusts, the Gould and I'm forgetting the names of all the families. Samuelson was the lawyer, but the various railroad trusts, the banking trusts, and a lot of that was because President Lincoln was throwing enormous amounts of free land and cash at the railroads in order to build an infrastructure that he could use to fight the war, you know, for the military. And then there was no way to regulate them, and the modern corporation really came into being post-Civil War. And they got so much power, you had the charter-mongering era, the, you know, the 1880s, 1890s, and all these abuses. And there were attempts to stop that with the Sherman Antitrust Act and the Tillman Act, but ultimately, over the long term, they were unsuccessful.
It seems like the money powers of corporate interests and military industrial interests seem to always be able to head us off at the path.
Yeah.
Money
is power, and enormous amounts of money, you know, represent enormous power in government. Ross, thank you for the call. I've been really struggling with this. Last week I said, you know, next weekend I'm going to go see Lincoln. It wasn't playing here in D.C. last weekend. So tomorrow, Louise and I are going to see it with, I think with Joe and Sherry Madison. And it should be real interesting. I have heard people who are Civil War scholars, and I'm not that familiar with the Civil War era. I mean, I've read the history books, but, you know, I spent years studying the Revolutionary War era. I can blow out statistics and people and names and dates and places all day long. You know, I can paint a picture of the Revolutionary War era. I can't do that with the Civil War. I need to learn more about it. But I have talked with Civil War scholars who suggest that had Lincoln simply said to the South, okay, see you guys later, that the North might have been just fine, thank you very much, and that over the course of a couple of generations rather than a couple of years, slavery would have come to an end in the South, in part because it wasn't so necessary any longer. Automation was happening. The cotton gin, you know, was invented in the 1830s, Eli Whitney. It allowed one machine to do the work of 50 slaves. And then in addition, as we moved into the 1880s, 1890s, 1900, early 1900, tractors started replacing horses and mules. And, you know, as automation was coming to agriculture, the need for slavery in the South was vanishing. So had Lincoln, you know, the one of the histories I read some years ago suggested that Lincoln really thought that this was going to be a 3-week war, much like George Bush thought the Iraq war was going to be a 3-week war or even a 3-day war, like his daddy had, you know, when he kicked Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. And Lincoln misjudged it and ended up with this incredible, horrific, bloody, the bloodiest war in American history in terms of, you know, the percentage of our population who died, the number of people who died. And that, you know, right now we would be two nations, the Confederate States of America and the United States of America, and, you know, that might not be such a terrible thing. I just don't know. You know, it's really interesting to kind of go back and write, and, you know, it's almost a science fiction experiment. It's like I read a novel, a couple of decades ago, about Hitler. You know, it was one of these alternative reality novels in which Hitler actually conquered Europe and stopped. Said, okay, you know, Germans now run Europe, fascist machine. And within a generation, Hitler was overthrown by all the various people in all the various countries in Europe because, hey, people don't like that kind of government. and all these Americans and all these Russians didn't die. A lot of people did die. I mean, obviously, a lot of Europeans died. But it's like you never know. I mean, I continue to think that World War II was a war that we should have involved ourselves in. The Civil War, I don't know. And I would, you know, in fact, my wife Louise is more of the opinion, you know, kind of let them go. And I get it, Lincoln, you know. Generations fought and died for this United States of America. So we're going to break it up over the issue of slavery? No. I get that. I understand.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So I'm going to add somewhat to my education about the Civil War era by going to see the Lincoln movie this weekend. I'll report back next week, although that was certainly not going to make me an expert.
Ain't that good news, man, ain't that news.
Yeah, it's time for our news report from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman. If you haven't done it yet, get over there now to free-don.org. You can read all about it there. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us and coming in by Skype as well. Hey, Victoria. Nice to see you.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up?
Well, disturbing dueling statements coming out of Israel and the Gaza Strip today. Mm. On the one hand, Abu Obeidah, spokesman for the military wing of Hamas, saying this on the day that they have sent rocket attack into Jerusalem, which didn't land in the city itself but outside, saying we are sending a short and simple message. There is no security for any Zionist or any single inch of Palestine, and we plan more surprises. And then this from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, saying the Israeli army was continuing to hit Hamas hard and is ready to expand the operation into Gaza.
Yeah. As the New York Times pointed out today, the equation has changed considerably. Hamas now has the country of Qatar, which is an ally of the United States, and the country of Egypt, an ally of the United States, and then the next-door neighbor, where Gaza butts up against, basically on the side of Hamas. And that was not the case 5 years ago, 4 years, 3 years ago. And
that's right.
So we have, we have some really conflicting... I was going to say conflicting interests. That's probably too strong a phrase, but it's very interesting how the dynamics are changing now, and it's going to be interesting to see if both sides end up hardening and this leads to war, which would be a tragedy for both the Israelis and the Palestinians, or if this causes more flexibility on the part of the Israelis and perhaps on the part of the Palestinians as well, saying, okay, you know, we won't send any more rockets if you'll, you know, let us have our country.
These are not flexible guys.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's the problem.
This is the problem.
Although there is a very robust debate about this inside Israel. And,
there is.
And you can read about it in Haaretz online. You know, it's the liberal newspaper, the version of The Guardian, I guess, in Israel.
Yes.
The debate is very, very well engaged in that country. We tend to be afraid to have it here. We don't talk about it here, but it's going on there.
So. It is. However, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, is up for re-election soon, and he does not view it as much of a debate, and he is hawkish,
and he
will be making those decisions.
And people tend to get re-elected during times of military conflict.
Precisely.
As George
Precisely.
Bush pointed out.
Quite.
Yep.
Meantime, back here at the White House today, President Obama met with the bipartisan bicameral leadership, the Big Four, at the White House this morning to discuss the fiscal cliff or the fiscal slope, depending which particular definition you like to have of this particular not very nice view of where we could be
now,
on January the 3rd.
Who are the Big Four? Yeah, I get Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner. Was it? And
Harry
Mitch McConnell
Reed
and Harry
McConnell.
Reid. Yeah, of course,
yeah,
the Senate.
Harry Reid and Mitch
Sorry.
McConnell. They're the four.
Yeah, okay. So John Boehner showed up without Eric Cantor attached to his back with that little stiletto stuck in his kidney.
Yes, so he's able to be very much freer. They had a photo op at the beginning, and President Obama disarmed him by saying that it was his birthday tomorrow, Boehner's birthday tomorrow, and that they weren't going to have a cake because he didn't know how old he was. And Boehner said, well, I'm pretty sure you do, actually, Mr. President, because, you know, presidents can find things out.
Right.
And but he looked very touched and very pleased. He looked about eight.
Isn't that sweet?
And it was a really delightful moment. The president put his hand on his arm, and it was a very warm moment. After the meeting, which lasted well over an hour, the four leaders came out, not president, the four leaders came out. They were referring to each other by first names. Everybody was smiling. Everybody was saying they wanted to get there from here, and they were all indicating, including Mitch McConnell, which is interesting because he's really the wild card here because he has an election in 2014 and doesn't want to face a primary from the right. He was also indicating he wants to get there from here, but nothing's going to happen much because we've got Thanksgiving next week. But they are having talks on Wednesday.
But Mitch McConnell has to deal with the guys who were part of the caucus room conspiracy, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker, in the Senate. And John Boehner has to deal with the guys in the House who were part of the caucus room conspiracy, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Henseling, Pete Hoekstra, and Dan Lundgren. And when they go back to these guys who basically swore, you know, a blood oath, and Newt Gingrich, by the way, on this program last week, or this week, confirmed that this actually happened, this meeting. That, you know, when they go back to these guys who swore a blood oath to take down the president and crash the U.S. economy to do it, they're going to have a tough time.
Well, they are going to have a tough time. Now, Bob Corker actually is working with some of the other senators. There are quite a lot of senators working in different gangs, polls, and things like that.
Right.
Whatever names they've come up with, but they've come up with names on different ways to solve this. And I think that the senators actually believe that this is going to be solved in the Senate first, because I think they look on the House members as frat boys and rabble-rousers incapable of doing anything.
Right. Well, when you're speaking of the Tea Party freshmen, who will soon be sophomores, I guess, but that's not an inaccurate description of many of them.
Well, and I think they view them as sophomores, too.
Yeah.
Meantime, a new IAEA report, International Atomic Energy Agency, says Iran is set to sharply expand its uranium enrichment in its underground site of Fordo after installing all the fuel centrifuges it was built for. And they are quite concerned about this. They've put in place nearly 2,800 centrifuges, and it's poised to double the number of them operating, saying they can be started any day. They are ready.
Amazing. Now, is this to take it to weapons grade or to take it to nuclear fuel grade?
They shorten the time to get to a nuclear bomb.
Amazing. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Check out free-don.com or .org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday, although I do want to share a few of my news stories and thoughts with you before we get into your calls. The other, I shared with you this anonymous claim that they stopped Karl Rove from hacking the election, which makes perfect sense to me after watching what happened in 2004 and seeing the brilliant documentation of it, both by Bob Fitrakis and Harvey Wasserman, and by the fellow who wrote Boss Rove, Craig Unger, I think his name is. The other big story, or another big story that's out there today, is about Twinkies, Hostess, laying off over 10,000 people because they say they can't work out a deal with the union, which is nonsense. Here's what you need to know about this story. And Pab Subgenus wrote a great summary of this over at Democratic Underground. He said, in 1995, a company called International Bakeries, which really wasn't a bakery, it was essentially a vulture capital arm of a computer company called Data Processing Financial and General Corporation. Back in 95, they went on this huge spending spree. They not only bought Hostess, they bought the San Francisco French Bread Company, the John Jay Nissen Baking Company, Drake's My Bread Company, tons of other companies. They did it by borrowing like bat guano crazy and eventually defaulted on their loans, leading to bankruptcy in 2004. You with me so far? Hostess got bought out by basically a vulture capital arm of a computer company. And then they went broke in 2004. So in 2009, they emerged from bankruptcy. How did they get out of the bankruptcy? They went to GE Capital, Silverpoint, Monarch, and Ripplewood Holdings and borrowed money to get out of bankruptcy, which, of course, loaded the company with more debt payments, more interest payments, all this kind of stuff. And so now you've got a company that is so loaded in debt. It's been through two bankruptcies. The banksters have stole, you know, they've taken their pound of flesh more than the Mitt Romneys of the world. This is vulture capitalism. These are so-called private equity firms, what we used to call leveraged buyout firms, LBO companies, you know, strip and dump companies. They've taken their pound of flesh. The executives at Hostess are taking bonuses and very well paid, thank you very much. And the workers, and there's like a couple of billion dollars in the workers' pension fund that it looks like has been robbed. And the workers have already given up a substantial amount of their pay over the last decade as a result of these bankruptcies. I've seen various numbers, 25, 30, 35%. And finally, the workers said enough already. You know, we're not going to take another 30% cut in our pay just so that you guys can, you know, can drag some more debt in here. You can play musical chairs, bring another band of banksters in. What, are you going to sell it to Bain Capital next? And keep paying your CEOs and your senior executives massive amounts of money. We're not going to do it. And so the company says, okay, screw it. We're going to pull the plug. Well, they're going to pull the plug anyway. Basically, what you have is a company that since 1995 has not been run by a baking company. The people who own Hostess don't know anything about the baking industry. They don't know anything about bread. They don't know anything about cookies. They don't know anything about ho-hos. And you are in an American environment right now where increasingly, you walked through the store recently and looked at the labels on things where they say made with pure cane sugar. People don't want corn syrup. High fructose corn syrup. They're concerned that it causes obesity, it causes diabetes. Now there's this information out saying that Alzheimer's might be type 4 diabetes, and there might be some connection between that and sugar consumption. And what does that have to do with high fructose corn syrup? Nobody knows, but everybody's scratching their head. Except for those people who've been eating high fructose corn syrup for the last three decades, and they're going, what is today? Monday? Tuesday? I mean, it's so, you know, maybe it was the appropriate time for this company to die. Although, frankly, I think what's going to happen is you're going to see the company liquidated and somebody's going to buy the brand out of bankruptcy and reboot it again. You know, smaller, and maybe they'll come up with some health food versions. If they made a gluten-free, cane sugar-sweetened Twinkie, I would stand in line to buy it. I used to love Twinkies as a kid. But when I was a kid, Twinkies were made with real sugar. Anyway, I mean, who knows what kind of fat was in them when I was a kid. It was probably lard, right? Probably still is. I don't know. But this whole idea that is being pushed on the right and is being pushed so hard, it's going to be all over Fox News. It's all over the right-wing talk show hosts, you know. The unions killed another company. No, it was the vulture capitalists. It was the Romneys of the world who killed another company. And we need to change the tax code so that it's no longer advantageous. I mean, it used to be before the Reagan administration, you couldn't do this. Nobody did this. In the hundreds of, you know, the 200-year history of the United States, nobody was doing this. But Reagan changed the tax code to make it possible for somebody who doesn't have the money to walk into a company that's worth a pile of money, borrow the money equal to what that company is worth, buy that company with the borrowed money, and then dump the debt on the company and say, okay, you have to pay back the debt even though I borrowed the money. And when you're all done paying back the debt, I own you. You get this? This is the Bain Capital business model. I've seen them do this over and over and over. We've seen them do this with all these companies. They're doing it with Sensata right now. They're doing it with Clear Channel. They've been doing it with all these different companies. And it should, you know, it's wrong. We shouldn't have a tax code that incentivizes using debt to destroy companies. And we shouldn't have a tax code that says that when somebody does that, like Mitt Romney, that the maximum income tax they make on the money that they've basically stolen out of these companies is 15%, which is the highest tax rate that Mitt Romney ever confronts because he takes everything as capital gains. So, you know, the Republicans, they talk about closing loopholes. They talk about waste, fraud, and abuse in the tax code. Let's close some loopholes. Okay, here's a great one. Do away with the capital gains exemption or the capital gains rate. Make all income ordinary income, whether you earn it as, you know, working in the sewers under the city, whether you work, you earn it paving the roads, whether you earn it as a doctor taking care of people. Now, all those people, of course, are paying up to 36% income tax right now, or whether you earn it as a bankster or a stock trader, who right now are only paying a maximum 15% income tax. Or a variety of other kinds of businesses. You know, as the billionaire CEO of a health insurance company, where, yeah, you take $1 million or $2 million or $5 million paycheck on which you might pay up to 36% income tax. But then you take $100 million in stock options, wait a year or so to roll them over, exercise them, cash them in, and that's now considered a capital gain, 15% income tax. What's right about that? Nothing. Oh, we've got to keep the job creators happy. Nonsense. This is the 1% stealing money out of our economy. The 1/10th of 1%. The 1/1000th of 1% stealing money out of our economy. So there's a basic, there ain't nothing left. And then a hostess goes, hey, can't do it anymore. Anyhow, it's Anything Goes Friday. Enough of my rants. We will pick up your calls right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Your calls, my rants on your calls, and a little more of the news as we continue through the program.
Olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on in from the shocking, but now got gone. Ending gone.
Oh, there's Abraham Lincoln at the Lincoln Memorial last weekend. Louise and I went to see the Bond movie and down in Georgetown, and we walked home, which was turned out 3.5 miles. Got lost on a little peninsula between there and here and crossed over the highway and everything, but it's a great walk. But on the way, we passed the Lincoln Memorial, and I said, I hadn't seen it yet. I've lived here in Washington, D.C. for 2 years. I've been to the Jefferson Memorial. I've been to the archives. We got our ID card at the archives so we can go through things. We've seen a few of the things, but hadn't seen the Lincoln Memorial. And so we went last weekend. It was quite the thing to see. Kevin in Clearwater, Florida. Hey, Kevin. It says here, the head of the Georgia GOP invited Alan West to move to Georgia. Seriously?
I was just trying to Google it real quick, but I heard it, listened to a lot of the various shows. You, of course, my favorite. I just was howling yesterday, but I was waiting for an important call, so I couldn't call then, that, Yes, the head of the, I believe it was a woman, and they identified her as the head of the Georgia Republican Party, and that she was distraught that Alan West, the great American, had lost, and that he would be more than welcome to move to Georgia and become elected. And it was funny because it tied in with the story you were saying. You had something about some conspiracy theory in Georgia.
Yeah, well, we interviewed the guy yesterday who says that that the president is using mind control techniques developed by the Rand Corporation during the Cold War to get us to accept Agenda 21, which is the UN suggestion that when the nations of the world build cities, that they do so using mixed use and eco-friendly, you know, to make the world a little more livable and tolerable place. And that this nefarious plot.
If mind control doesn't work, then you can always hold a gun up to their head and fire it off in their ear, as we've known Mr. West to do.
Is that what Alan West did? That's why he got kicked out of the military.
He was charged
right.
The military for, I think they were interrogating an Iraqi policeman.
Right, yeah. Amazing.
And he
amazing.
Fired that off. But I've already pasted everywhere I can on my Twitter and Facebook that amazing story about Anonymous that you had today, and I looked it up on Wonkhead and shared it on my page.
Great.
That
great. That's a story that really needs to get some legs, and I hope we hear, you know, not speaking for our program, but I hope we as a nation hear from Anonymous with some enough detail that we can take this seriously. Because if we do, you know, if they can provide the detail, they could also be providing the basis for a criminal prosecution of Karl Rove, not only for trying to steal the 2012 election, but for stealing the 2004 election. And that would be a turning point in American history. Kevin, thank you for the call. Much appreciated. Camille in Albuquerque, New Mexico, says, you want to disagree with me about Southern states seceding? Let me make it clear. I haven't taken a position on this. I've just raised the question. But your thoughts?
Yeah, you raised the question, and you were talking about it kind of like super intellectually about maybe it would have been better if Lincoln would have just let the Southern states go, and that gradually over time, because of, you know, industrialization, that we wouldn't need slaves anymore.
Well, my point was slavery was on the way out anyway at that point.
That it was on the way out. But the thing that struck me, and I've been reading your book, Rebooting the American Dream, and just earlier this morning I read the part about, I think it was when you lived in Georgia and you had a German exchange student,
mm-hmm.
and you guys went to go see the movie Schindler's List,
right.
with him, with the exchange student, and you talked about how he broke down crying like halfway through the movie and didn't stop crying for an hour afterwards, and he said, you know, I learned in school, he was German.
Right.
He said, I learned in school that we did these things, but until this movie, I didn't really, really know we did these things.
Right.
And he was just heartbroken. And I just, it struck me the way you were so intellectually talking about this and discussing slavery, like enslaving people and their children and separating families.
Yep.
And the other thing that just struck me is right after that break, I love you. I mean, I love your work. I don't attribute anything bad to you, but except maybe intellectualizing this a little too much. Mm-hmm. You came back from the break with your Free Don Siegelman thing and then went into the news. And it's like if the entire South, instead of black African slaves, they were Don Siegelmans.
Yeah.
And, you know...
Well, you make a very good point.
Really ironic.
You make a very good point. And in fact, it was your point is the pivot point of my reluctance to say that, you know, to say that on the air, because slavery not only was a cruel and inhumane institution, it was those words just don't do it justice. I mean, you know, it was brutality. Particularly when you read the accounts of what the lives of many slaves were like in the era of slavery, it is unimaginable, right? It's just absolutely unimaginable, and you're absolutely right.
I think it's important.
That said,
your exchange.
Have you read any of the stories of what the war was like, the Civil War?
Yes, I have, and that was brutal too. I mean, all the way around.
So it's like brutality versus brutality. Which one? I mean, was the price, if slavery was going to end within the next generation anyway, and I believe it was, then was it worth 600,000 people dying and several million people being maimed and families being torn apart to, you know, I don't know. I'm not asserting that it was or it wasn't. I'm saying that that this must have been just one hell of a decision for Abraham Lincoln.
It must have been an incredible decision. And I mean, I agree. I mean, it must have been hard both ways and it's tragic both ways. But to me, I don't know, for some reason, just without giving it a lot of thought, what I would like is for your exchange student, I wish that kind of information that your exchange student experienced would just be able, like everyone would be able to experience that.
Yeah, you're right, Camille. And perhaps, you know, not being African American, I'm missing a piece of this, a piece of this perspective that I need to go in search of. Thank you very much for the call. Thanks for the reality check.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You know, the blinders that we most often don't notice are the ones that we have ourselves. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour.
I need a big weekend. Can't be just a dance.
An oil rig has exploded in the Gulf of Mexico today. Two dead, two missing, four injured. Black Elk Energy has 854 wells on 155 different offshore drilling platforms, according to WWLTV.com. This apparently, the company, the Black Oak CEO John Hoffman, the guy in charge of the company, spent 18 years working for BP. Yikes. The ghost of BP, the son of BP. Chuck in Mosier, Oregon. Hey, Chuck, you got some thoughts about Hostess and Twinkies?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Been listening for a while and been called in a few times. But anyway, I was wondering what your take was on Hostess. And I think it was just a couple years ago, maybe during that 2010 election or something like that, they did talk about closing down. But I'm wondering if they've been hanging on in bankruptcy, not just for Romney, but now that Romney didn't win, you know, they probably decided to close up, pull the tent down. They got all, probably all the benefits they could over the last couple of years, and we're going to really milk it out a whole bunch more. But
that's possible. It's possible that if Romney had won, they might have tried to just, you know, drag it out a little longer and squeeze a little more cash out of it. But frankly, I suspect that this was not a political decision. And the reason why I say that is that if they had closed 2 weeks before the election and said, you know, hey, a union took us down and we're having to fire over 10,000 workers or lay them off, I think that that probably would have accrued some political benefit to the Romney campaign. There wouldn't have been time, particularly if they'd done it 3 or 4 days before the election, there wouldn't have been time for the unions to respond. There wouldn't have been time for the story to get out that, no, you know, the banksters have been screwing with this company since 1995. They have milked it dry. They've bankrupted it twice. They've stolen the employee pension fund. You know, and so I think if they wanted to use it for political purposes, the timing's off. But I get your point. And, you know, it's entirely possible. Chuck, thanks for the call. Mitchell in Mahwah, New Jersey. Hey, Mitchell, what's up?
Hey, hey, Tom. You know, I'll tell you, it's like Chinese water torture listening to the demise of Twinkies, you know, for two hours on hold. Anyway, I wanted to ask you about the unemployment insurance extensions.
Sure.
It's rarely talked about, but a couple of million people are going to get kicked off the rolls at the end of this year, and I had hope to ask Senator Sanders about that, but I didn't have time, and I was wondering if you knew anything about it.
Yeah, the you're talking about as a consequence of the sequestration kicking in?
Well, it's the all the extensions are set to expire no matter where people are in receiving them as of December 31st. So it's,
right.
And it's no longer 99 weeks. It was rolled back, I think, to 76 weeks. And
yeah.
So even if you have like 27 weeks of benefits and you're in a state which has still high unemployment, although, I mean, the numbers are coming down, but there are still 10 states over 9% unemployment rates. No matter where you are in that benefit period, it's ending. So whether you have 40 weeks or 28 weeks or whatever, just the base 26 is going to be the only
and this,
thing left.
And this in part came out of a compromise that the president did with the Republicans. I am personally of the opinion that what the White House should do is put together a package that is the most immediate of the things that will happen with when sequestration kicks in, when the fiscal cliff kicks in. First of all, everybody's taxes go up slightly, but more importantly, people who are on long-term unemployment benefits, the federally funded ones, those checks will stop being written. So, but the problem that the Republicans have is that they have sworn loyalty to a multimillionaire K Street lobbyist here in Washington, D.C., a fellow by the name of Grover Norquist, who does not go quietly into that dark night. He's kicking and screaming and he still has considerable influence and a lot of power and controls millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars between him and the people aligned with him, that can be used to destroy the political lives of Republicans who don't fall in line. So the Republicans have all sworn this oath not to raise taxes. So basically, I think that the Republicans are going to have to wait until January 1st to vote to cut taxes, because on December 31st, taxes will have gone up. Similarly, on December 31st, those unemployment checks will cease. And as part of that legislation to cut middle class taxes, on January 1st or, the 2nd or 3rd or whatever, there also needs to be legislation that reboots those unemployment checks so that the period of time where the unemployment checks aren't going out is minimized to a few days, maybe a week at the most. I don't see any other way that it's going to happen politically, personally. But, I'm also – there's a certain amount of cynicism. Cynicism is maybe the wrong word, but I don't see the Republicans all of a sudden singing Kumbaya.
I don't either. Tom, there's so much villainizing of like food stamp benefits and unemployment benefits and what have you. And, when you look at a program like the defense program, like the F-22,
mm-hmm.
You have a plane which is $69 billion, which is kind of all kinds of mechanical problems, and pilots don't even want to fly it, and they're saying it's not safe.
Yep.
And the whole unemployment program for a year is like $30 billion, and the whole food stamp program is like for the entire country is like $80 billion. And it's just, it's just unbelievable how villainized and how, terrorized people have become by the language and the.
Yeah, this all started with Reagan, going off about the welfare queen. I mean, this, and much of this villainization of the poor, by the way, is racial code. And even though most of the poor people in the United States are white, most Americans and certainly most Fox News viewers don't know that. And whenever Fox runs B-roll of poor people, it's always black poor people. And just like the other day, they were running B-roll of Hispanic voters, and they were the B-roll that they were running, the video that runs in the background when they're talking about the Hispanic vote. The Chyron, in fact, the letters on the bottom of the screen said the Hispanic vote, and it was pictures of people hopping over the border from Mexico. It's like, what? But you're right, and it has been villainized now for 30 years to the point that Bill Clinton even said we need to end welfare as we know it, and he did, and which was during a boom time, didn't seem to hurt anybody all that badly, but is really hurting a lot of people right now. All this stuff needs to be revisited. Mitchell, thank you for the call. It needs to be revisited in a very real and important way. S.E. Cupp, the conservative who's on MSNBC now that network is adding more and more conservative voices, and Joe Scarborough, of course, doing gangbusters in the morning for them, came on. She was talking with this. She's part of this program called The Cycle, midday show, and which I must confess I've never seen, so I can't speak authoritatively about it. But she, I beg your pardon? Oh yeah, because I'm on the air when it's on apparently. Or I'm getting ready for being on the air. I'm not sure exactly when it is, but don't watch TV during the day. In any case, she said, she quoted this right-wing talking point, and a nice piece about this, by the way, by Stephen Webster over at Raw Story. She said, I think everyone can agree we'd like to decrease poverty, even though conservatives have been maligned for, quote-unquote, wanting to cut social safety net programs and the social safety net. Expanding welfare has not reduced poverty. In fact, adding millions to the ranks of welfare has seen poverty explode over the past 4 years. And to her eternal credit, Sister Campbell, Sister Simone Campbell, the nun, one of the nuns on the bus who's been on this program, she's been on our TV program, she said, excuse me, but that data is really wrong. And, you know, and then she, Sister Campbell went off on, you know, it's the minimum wage. In 1970, she said, if you earned the minimum wage, you were above the poverty level. But because the minimum wage hasn't been raised in almost a generation, right now, if you're on the minimum wage, you're earning well below the poverty level. It would have to be around 12 and a half bucks to get you right to the edge of the poverty level, which is where it would be if it had been inflation adjusted since 1960. So there's that. But then Stephen Webster correctly points out Social Security has reduced the number of elderly people in poverty from 15.3 million down to 3.8 million. That's a big deal because Social Security is not a retirement program. It is an insurance program against poverty in old age as well as disasters in younger age. And then, you know, 90% of welfare benefits go to assisting people who are elderly, disabled, or members of working households. Now, you listen to conservatives and you would think 90% of welfare benefits go to single moms who have 12 children so that they can collect, $100 a month more for each kid, and they're all living in government-subsidized housing and drinking champagne that they pay for with food stamps. Wrong. 90% of welfare benefits go to people who are elderly, disabled, or members of working households, and not to working-age Americans who choose to work. Who choose not to work. That's the phrase that the conservatives use. And I can tell you there's a lot of working-age Americans who would love to work. Franklin Roosevelt famously said, the best welfare program is a job. And when he looked out at 35% unemployment in the United States in 1932, he said, okay, we got to do something about this. The best welfare program, a job. Instead of passing out money to people, we're going to put them to work. We're going to rebuild the national forest. We're going to replant the national forest. We were having the Dust Bowl because our forest has been cut down. Let's replant them. Let's build bridges. Let's build buildings. Let's build schools. Let's build hospitals. He did it. He got us out of the Great Depression and got a lot of people out of poverty.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we need to have a serious conversation in the United States about poverty and about how to get out of poverty and go back and reevaluate those welfare programs that Bill Clinton cut apart.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, our executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the folks at the various companies that syndicate our program, Pacifica Radio, Dial Global, Free Speech TV, On Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show as television, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, the cable radio network, CRN. We need to add that to the list, Danielle. To all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RT TV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, by the way, hey to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and most importantly for you, thank you for supporting our program. Thanks for calling your radio station and telling them that you appreciate the program. Thanks for calling our sponsors and telling them that you're going to use their products or recommend their products or just that you appreciate their supporting the radio stations, the television stations, whatever it may be, however you're getting this program. Thank you. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, thank you so much for taking my call, and also happy belated anniversary to you and Louise. And I tried to bring as much awareness to the Hunter School as I possibly could do on Facebook and on Reddit and stuff.
Thank you. Hunterschool.org is the website. In fact, we're having another board of directors meeting this weekend. I'm looking forward to finding out how things are going. What's up?
Good. Well, I wanted to share a quick personal story and kind of tie it into the whole current marijuana legalization debate.
Mm-hmm.
My younger and only brother, Mike, passed away last year at age 31 in his sleep.
Oh, my.
In a house that he shared with his friends. He was an awesome guy. I mean, graduated from Eastern in communications, loved to be fit and healthy, worked out in a week, probably more than I do in a year. However, suffered chronic back pain from working at a company that had him doing deliveries nonstop for almost a decade, you know, up at 4 a.m., running around delivering a popular energy drink. So anyway, so they did the autopsy, and the toxicology report came back that he died of an oxycodone intoxication from prescriptions that he was seeing a so-called pain management doctor for. So those prescriptions.
And that, by the way, is one of the leading causes of death in the United States right now. Abusive medications, pain medications.
Correct, and it's been known for many civilizations that it's a bad medicine. But anyway, I think Mike would have been better off doing something other than 130 pills a month of oxycodone, which is basically powdered heroin. You know, and the sad thing is he never had a chance to see if other alternate medications would even work, because he was looking to join the Chicago Firefighters, or I think he passed the police force exam. Serving his call to civil duty, that would have drug tested him for something like THC, but not for the corporate powder pill.
So is the essence of what you're saying, Marty, that if pot were legal in Illinois, that your younger brother might have been able to use that for pain management? And there's a huge body of literature that backs this up, that pot works for pain management, that he could have used that instead of oxycodone and he'd still be alive today?
He would still be alive today. I am 100% certain of that. I mean, and I know my younger brother, and we're actually trying to find some kind of legal avenue to go after the doctor he was seeing, but he didn't have any descendants. He wasn't married. So there's a lot of lawyers that we've talked to that won't touch it because there's not that much to really gain from it. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I do. And besides that, it's difficult to go after these docs. And frankly, there are some people who are in serious pain. Apparently your brother was one of them. And you go to a doctor and the doctor couldn't prescribe pot to him. I mean, basically the oxycodone was the only thing he had in his bag of tricks. And, it's a sad and bad alternative. I'm with you. We need to decriminalize pot. And I think the dam is broken. I think that, Washington State and Colorado voting to decriminalize pot and now we have two other states where the state legislatures are going to be discussing it in the next few weeks. I predict within 10 years that, and probably within three, that the Nixon's drug war, at least the marijuana portion of Nixon's drug war, will be a distant, painful, and horrific memory. Marty, thank you for sharing what must have been a very painful story with us. And I totally agree. Your point is so well made. Thank you. Roger in St. Cloud, Florida. We have 1 minute to the end of the show. It's yours.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call. I'd just like to say about the Medicaid, Medicare. My mom is 64 years old. She injured her back roughly. Her fourth, fifth, and sixth vertebrae is totally gone in her back.
Mm-hmm.
And she worked all of her life to raise me and my sister. And she only gets a little over $700 a month to live on.
From Social Security disability?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Social Security and Medicaid. And I'm an over-the-road truck driver, and I support her, and I live on the road a month at a time, and I only get like 2 to 3 days off.
Wow.
In other words,
your point is that we need to be caring for our disabled in a way that at least allows them to have some dignity in their life and not live in poverty?
Yes, sir. I mean, she couldn't even go to a medical system because she don't have the money.
Yeah, I'm totally with you, Roger. And this would not happen, by the way, Your mother would not be in this situation if she lived in any of the other developed nations in the world, the other 34 OECD nations. Only in America have we let the right-wing crazies take over our country so that we have billionaires like the Kochs and we've got people in poverty like the mom. Coming up, thank you for the call. Coming up tomorrow on the or Monday on the Tom Hartman program, we'll catch up on all the important news and information you might as well have missed, as well as the latest on the so-called fiscal cliff. Most important, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get over to pdamerica.org. Get over to movetoamend.org. Show up. Tag, you're it. Get out there, occupy something. Go to rollingjubilee.org. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.